Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Among those who took home this year's Breakthrough Prize, the biggest prize money in science, there was local researcher Stephen Elledge. He is the Gregor Mendel Professor of Genetics at Brigham and Women's Hospital and at Harvard Medical School. And his work provides insight into how our cells repair themselves. Elledge says he's still determining how to spend his $3 million prize, but he's giving at least one-third of it to charity. And we talked with Stephen Elledge earlier today, and I began by congratulating him and asking him what his first reaction was when he'd heard he'd won the Breakthrough Prize.
Well, I was, you know, shocked and elated at the same time because I knew that this was a really big award, and I was really, really happy about it. It was it's a great honor.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the research that you won the Breakthrough Prize for. You're one of the experts in cell biology. So what is it that attracted the attention of the Breakthrough Committee?
I think the Breakthrough Committee was mostly interested in the work that we did on how cells understand when their chromosomes are broken and then what they do to try to remedy that. And so the work that I'd done, and it's been over the last 20, 25 years, really started a long time ago when I was a postdoc, I discovered that in mammalian cells, they can tell when there's a problem in duplicating their DNA. And this is a very complicated process. And it turns out that cells or DNA can actually sense its own integrity. Mm. It can tell when there's a problem with it, and it then sets up a sort of signaling apparatus, sort of like a radio station, and it sends out signals to sort of muster the troops, get them together to carry out the different processes that are required to make sure that the DNA and the chromosome get repaired properly and everything stays intact.
So I can immediately sense some of the power or potential in this research, right? Like there are all sorts of chromosomal abnormalities, cancerous cells, that if we understood these processes that you were talking about better and were able to harness them, like, could they be potential cures for these things?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of a two-edged sword. And if you don't have this pathway, we call it the DNA damage response pathway. If you don't have it at all, the cell can't even divide. So one cell can't become two cells. That cell just dies. If you tweak it just a little bit, you take away part of it, then you can still go forward, but you've lost the fidelity. So then you get all kinds of problems in your DNA, and every time you try to divide, there's more problems. And this is the sort of thing that leads to cancer. So that's one side of the coin. But it turns out, and a lot of cancer cells do sort of turn off parts of this pathway, and one of these, one of the genes that's really controlled by this pathway is called P53, which is a major tumor suppressor, and it gets activated when you damage DNA. So cancer cells don't want that because it stops cells from growing. So when you evolve into a cancer cell, you often turn off part of this pathway. But that leaves the tumor cell more vulnerable and more dependent on the rest of the pathway. So there are cancer therapies now that have been developed that turn off other parts of the pathway and try to kill the cancer cells without killing the normal cells.
Uh-huh.
They call that a therapeutic index. And you can think of it sort of like a stool, and you can take away one part, one leg, and it can still stand up. But if you take away two legs, it's just going to fall over.
Right.
So the cancer cell's taken away one leg. You can take away another leg with chemical inhibitors of the pathway and hopefully kill the cancer cell. So that's an interesting strategy that is now in the clinic. So I think I'm interested in seeing how that works. So I think it's going to be very exciting.
Does it amaze you still to this day that your work, I mean, just listening to you describe it, I'm like, here's a man who's unlocking the mysteries of the chemistry of life. Do you feel that same sense of amazement?
Well, once in a while I do. You know, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you go to work and you start thinking about this problem, and then you go, well, how can I solve this problem? And how can I trick the cell into telling me the answer to this question? You know, and so you devise some way to get it to trick you into that. And then, you know, you learn things, and then you realize that they have other ramifications that you hadn't appreciated initially. And it's just this step-by-step thing where you don't always know where you're going, but once you get there, you're now, say, at a higher plane. You can look over and you see other things. And, of course, you know, we're you know, no scientist is an island. Yeah. And so other people start working on the pathways. They discover new things. And, you know, I end up getting a lot of credit for, I think, the things that other people have done. But I think if you're the first person there, then that's sort of, that's the way prize committees work.
Right, right.
You know, but a lot of people work on this.
Well, I'm wondering if we can step back in time a little bit and let me ask you about when you were a kid. I mean, do we have a particular person to thank who in either directly or indirectly engendered a love of science in you?
You know, I don't know if there's a single person. I went to a Catholic school for 6 years. I don't even recall being taught any real science there. Certainly math. I learned my numbers there. But they had a reading program. So they had these four-page laminated pamphlets, and they got into science. And so there was one on dinosaurs, you know, and that just blew my mind that these animals lived long ago and roamed the earth, and you could study them by finding their bones, you know. So I just wanted to be a paleontologist. I thought that was the most exciting thing. And then you learned about planets, you know, so, you know, the solar system, that there's this world out there, and those little dots in the sky are stars, and so that blew my mind. And then I learned about atoms.
Yeah.
And that everything that you could see was made up of something smaller, and that was made up of something smaller. And, you know, so from the very large to the very small, it just caught my imagination. And I wanted to be a chemist. And that's pretty much what I did. I mean, I was really interested in that. I went to the library, took out a chemistry book, couldn't understand any of that. I was probably in fifth grade or something, and my grandmother got me a chemistry set. She worked at Montgomery Ward's in the catalog department. She ran the accounting there, and she got me this chemistry set, and I did all the experiments. And then I started making random combinations and blew up my ceiling in the kitchen.
You didn't?
Yeah, really? Well, it just didn't blow up the ceiling. I mean, it just exploded and shot up and hit the ceiling and made this orange mark on the ceiling.
What were you mixing?
I don't know, but it was bubbling. It generated some gas fast.
Okay.
You know, so it shot it all out.
I was thinking, like, what? This wouldn't be right for a home chemistry set, but I'm remembering from what? Like high school chemistry classes where what they give you, like, a piece of sodium that
you
expose to air
sodium,
or something. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because I went through all the I ran through all the alcohol they gave me, this wood alcohol. So I went up to the pharmacy and I said, I want to buy some wood alcohol. And they wouldn't sell it to me, you know, because they thought I was going to drink it. And of course, that's poison.
You're like, no, I'm going to blow stuff up. Even
so
better.
I had to get my grandmother to go up there and go, no. He just wants it for his chemistry set, you know, so I could have a Bunsen burner kind of thing going so I could heat up my reactions. And that was pretty funny. But mostly it was things like making perfume soap. You know, that's what you know, thing. It worked. It was great. You know, it was fun. But yeah, so then I got interested in science. And then I went, my big, you know, probably the big thing that propelled me forward after that, I got to take chemistry in high school. And I won this Wabash Valley chemistry contest where all these people came from all the schools. I had first year chemists and I got first place. So anyway, I got interested in chemistry that way, and I just went on from there.
That sounds so cool. Now you find yourself doing your research and your work here at Harvard and at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. What is it like to work in the Boston area right now in this field? Because it seems like there's been such an explosion of research and development in genetics and biology and chemistry in you know, like the hub of research we have here.
Yeah, well, you know, the Boston area is great. I mean, there's just everything is going on here. But it's not just here. It's going on everywhere. I mean, there's just been an explosion. And every few years, there's just another leap forward in the amount of information that's available to a scientist. And so it's a great time to be a biologist and a great time to be a geneticist.
Yeah.
So it's exciting.
Before I let you go, we noted that last month when you accepted the Breakthrough Prize, you were at NASA Ames, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on stage, you said, quote, it's important for our society to promote the culture of science. And that you also talked about the winds blowing against science. Why do you feel compelled to say that?
Well, I've given a few speeches that incorporate those same ideas. And it's been going on for quite a while. And what I meant by the winds blowing against science is that there are organized efforts to discredit science in certain spheres. And this really has to do with wealth and money, right? There are people who stand to gain quite a bit by selling certain products or carrying out, you know, certain types of company-based functions that generate a lot of money for them.
We're seeing this most explicitly in climate science.
Yeah, we're climate science, but that's just the first step. Anything else that gets in the way is also going to be criticized. And scientists have been personally, you know, attacked, and attacked as a group, and discredited and saying, oh, they're making this up. This is all fake, all the data, and they try to get some example of this. But I think it's just really important that people just push back and say, look, it's really funny. To me, it's hilarious, actually, the idea that scientists are going to put out something that's not true. Because if one scientist said something that was wrong, the next scientist would just take delight in disproving them. And the idea that they're all going to get together and make up some phony story is preposterous. But I think that the idea that people who are earnestly trying to use reasoning and facts to answer important questions for our society, that they're being criticized and maligned, I think we have to push back at that. Because if you let that happen, then that's opening a door that you don't want to go through.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said that it's all of our responsibilities to defend science and promote fact-based reasoning and rationality. Isn't that ever harder when the whole idea of fact-based is one of the things that's come into question at least in politics, right?
Well, yeah, and that certainly entered my mind when I made that statement. And I think it's even more important to try to promote fact-based reasoning and rationality in the face of what is now an organized effort at fake news and what they call the post-truth era. This has to end. And we have to go back to actually dealing with reality and real facts. I think it's really important for our democracy, for one thing, but for the world.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Ellidge is the Gregor Mendel Professor of Genetics at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He's also one of this year's winners of the Breakthrough Prize. Professor Ellidge, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on winning the Breakthrough Prize and for all your terrific research. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thank you very much.
We spoke with Professor Ellidge a little earlier today, and since it is